Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall and I'm joined today with our third member who you've not yet met. It's John Tennant. How's it going, John?
I'm good, thanks, Dave. How are you?
I'm okay, thank you. So, where are you?
I'm just at Imperial College getting ready to do some demonstrating tomorrow.
Demonstrating? So that's what are you going to be doing in that?
I'm going to be teaching undergrads how to identify the basic rock types. Should be fun.
Oh, good, good.
No fossils, though, yet. That's next week.
What's your PhD about?
Yeah, I'll be investigating the Jurassic Cretaceous boundary to see if there's hidden mass extinction in terrestrial vertebrates. So this is taking a raw biodiversity curve and correcting for various geological megabiases, such as sampling effects and Lagerstätten effects. And as well as that, we'll be looking in detail about how some groups responded to things like climate change over this period. And yeah, it kind of ties into a larger project looking at Mesozoic biodiversity. Should be great. Lots of dinosaurs, lots of crocs.
Cool. So what can you tell us about this episode today?
Yeah, today we're talking to Alex Liu, who's a recent doctor from Cambridge University, who has been investigating the Ediacaran biodiversity, which are these early macro fossils preserved within volcanic ash beds in Newfoundland. And they've gone as a quite a cool insight into the very early origins of large-bodied animals, you know, some 530 million years ago.
Hey, sounds great. Let's go straight into it.
Hi Alex, glad you could be with us here today.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
Cool, well we just want to get kick-started by asking what made you want to study these Ediacaran fossils? How did they capture imagination in the first place?
Really I was getting into paleontology when I was very small, so I loved dinosaurs and was drawing them all the time, every day. But it wasn't until I actually got to university that really found out that paleontology is what I wanted to do. And it was really some lectures we had by one of the professors I had as an undergraduate, Martin Brazier in Oxford, who is an expert on Ediacaran fossils and organisms. And all the questions that he was putting to us about all the unknowns, basically, in Ediacaran research made me think that that was what I wanted to do. There are so many things I could go into, so many avenues to explore. And that's what got me into this sort of period of research.
So what is the current consensus of when complex multicellular life evolved?
That really depends on what you're classing as complex. And there are a lot of multicellular organisms such as algae, fungi, some biomineralizing protists, so single-celled organisms, and amoebae, as far back as maybe 720 million years ago. But they're not at all considered to be things that may have evolved into animals. And so if you're talking about complex multicellular organisms in the context of the Ediacara biota, it's things that could potentially have been ancestors to animals. And for those, we're looking at around the oldest fossils being 580 million years ago. There are two assemblages really that stand out. The Duxiantou microfossil assemblage in China, where there are proposed animal embryos being preserved, and also the first large complex organisms being found in Newfoundland around the same sort of time. So that's what the fossils are telling us. In terms of molecular clocks, which is where you work back from the genetics of modern organisms to try and work out when groups of different animals split, the lineages split, and they evolved from each other, they would suggest that complex multicellular organisms existed even further back, say around 630 or even 700 million years ago.
You mentioned fossil embryos. I mean, that sounds amazing. How do people actually know that they're embryos, and how do they differentiate them from just grains of sand?
So these embryos, they're recognized on the basis of their cell division. So it looks like you have groups of these tiny little cells, all 7 millimeter, that are arranged as bundles of 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, so on. And they were proposed as embryos in the 1990s, but more recent work, mostly led by the University of Bristol, has suggested that they may not even be embryos, they may be bacterial or protist-like. And if they are embryos, that they might not even be animals necessarily. And there's a lot more research needs to go on to get to the bottom of that, but it's one of the most controversial areas of Ediacaran paleontology at the moment.
A lot of the periods and ages are divided up by certain biological events. So is this the same for the Ediacaran?
The Ediacaran is a very special case because it was only defined as a geological period in 2004, so very recently. And as such, it hasn't officially been divided up into systems at all yet. There's an international sub-commission was set up to get started on that process only in August last month. So very recent developments. But if the question is how would you go about splitting up the Ediacaran period? And biology, which is used for most of the Phanerozoic periods as a delineating factor, may not work in this case because you only have the large complex organisms and macro fossils appearing around 580 million years ago, consistently over several regions. Before that, you only get microfossils with a few carbonized algal filaments. So using fossils alone is not going to be very useful. What we may well end up doing is looking at the geochemistry through these sequences. So there's a lot of carbon isotope excursions all the way through the Cryogenian, which is the period which hasn't officially been named yet, before the Ediacaran period, and Ediacaran itself. And by matching up the wiggles of those carbon isotope curves, we may be able to constrain and correlate all of the different regions. Another thing to look at is large-scale glacial events. There are three potential snowball Earth events over this time period, where it's hypothesized that the whole planet may have frozen over. That is probably an unlikely scenario, and it's more likely that you still had open oceans at this time. But there's a lot of evidence around to suggest that glacial deposits were very widespread, even at low latitudes, throughout the Cryogenian and parts of the Ediacaran. And if those can be correlated a bit better, through radiometric dating, then it might well be possible to use sedimentological features as ways of dividing up the time period.
So, why is it then that life in the Precambrian took so long to be identified? Was it just because they're kind of unrecognized blobs, or that people simply didn't believe that you could get fossils in rocks older than the Cambrian at the time?
I think it's a combination of that. So there's a long-held belief that if you go to Cambrian rocks, there's lots of shells, worm burrows. There's lots of evidence that life was around at that time. And in the 1800s, when the geological periods were being set out, that was something that scientists were looking for. And it was very clear to them that life in the Cambrian and onwards, but didn't seem to be much before. So there's partly these preconceived ideas, but also the Ediacaran macro fossils are often very simple in their shapes. So some are just simple rings or discs, and it's not clear that they are even biological. Another thing to remember is that they're quite rare in terms of fossil assemblages and also in terms of where the locations are. They're quite remote. So places such as the middle of Australia, the desert, or the Namibian deserts, or northern Siberia are all very difficult places to get to and not the typical places your gentleman paleontologist of the 1800s would go to. And therefore, that's probably the main reason why these things weren't seen earlier. They weren't what people were looking for in terms of bones and shells or burrows. None of those things existed in the Ediacaran. And all you get are these impressions of soft-bodied organisms, almost like footprints on a sand beach. impressed onto the rock surfaces.
Was there like a single piece of evidence then which led people to reconsider when complex life evolved? Or was it kind of like an accumulation of fragments of evidence, like fitting jigsaw pieces into a puzzle?
It was more an accumulation of evidence. So the first identification of possible biological structures in the Ediacaran was in the mid-1800s. So some small, simple discoidal things from Longmynd in Shropshire, and then some much larger but very simple ring structures from a quarry in Charnwood Forest in Leicestershire were described in the mid-1800s. And there's also a few discoidal things discussed from Canada, from St. John's, which was the provincial capital of Newfoundland. They actually discovered next to the post office there. But no one realized that these were biological structures. And so the trail went quiet for quite a number of years until the 1930s and 40s, when researchers started finding strange, large impressions in rocks, mostly sandstones, from Namibia and Australia. But it wasn't clear whether those were Precambrian or whether they actually could be organisms from within the Cambrian period itself, because these all occurred in rocks that were quite close to the known Cambrian boundary and known Cambrian organisms. So it wasn't until 1958 when a fossil called Charnia masoni was discovered in Leicestershire that it was really recognised that these things were truly Precambrian in age, because Charnia as a fossil occurs around 2 kilometres stratigraphically beneath the known Cambrian, lower Cambrian fossils of the UK. And so that discovery really spurred people on to find more evidence of life in Ediacaran settings, and has led to the roughly 40 localities globally that we know today.
You mentioned Charnia. That's quite close to home for me. Do you think scientists at the time were quite bewildered by it being found, because, you know, the rocks around there are like low-grade metamorphic, aren't they? And that's not really typical for fossils.
Yes. So they are strange. You look at rocks of a similar age in Newfoundland as well, which was contemporaneous and probably quite closely located geographically at the time these were all deposited. And they're quite similar, so very hard siliciclastic rocks with low-grade metamorphism, as you said. But these are all impressions of organisms on the bedding plane surfaces. So as long as you haven't had too much folding and fracturing of the rock surfaces, it's quite easy to still keep those impressions and still see them today. Charnia itself, though, was discovered by a schoolboy called Roger Mason, so that's where it got its species name from. But that was in the 1950s, and he was climbing with friends, actually a year after a schoolgirl had found the same impression, but she wasn't able to convince anyone of what she'd seen. But Roger was climbing and found this fern-like impression on a rock face in Charnwood, and went and got his dad and showed him, and his dad went to Trevor Ford, who was at the University of Leicester, and he recognised the importance of it and wrote it up. And from then on, Ediacaran researchers never really looked back.
A lot of your work is focused on the rocks at Mistaken Point. Could you tell us where this is and how old the rocks there are?
Yeah, so Mistaken Point is on the southeastern coast of Newfoundland and the eastern coast of Canada. And it's named Mistaken Point because it's very close to the actual corner of Newfoundland, which ships used to sail around, and they'd sail from New York all the way up. And St. John's, at the uppermost tip of Newfoundland, would have been the last place they could refuel before crossing the Atlantic. So they'd have to go around this corner and turn north towards St. John's. And unfortunately, this bit of rock that sticks out just before the corner often got mistaken for Cape Race, which is the actual cape around which the ships were meant to be going. And there's a lot of sea tragedies that took place in that area, lots of sunken ships and people losing their lives. So that's where Mistaken Point got its name. It's now an ecological reserve, so it covers around 20 kilometres of coastline, and all of that is Ediacaran, late Ediacaran rocks, aged between 580 and 560 million years old. And it's important as it's one of the few places on Earth where the first Ediacaran macrofossils appear.
Is the nature reserve for these fossils?
Yes, it's an ecological reserve. So it's a combination of the wildlife that's found there. There's a lot of bird nesting sites. Also the ecological habitat, it's called the Hyperoceanic Barrens. And it's a very desolate peat bog-like area with very tiny trees, say hundreds of years old, but no greater than about a foot in height. And it's quite weird and spooky. It's almost always covered in mist and fog. So it's a combination of the ecology, the bird habitat, and these fossil sites. And it's currently going for a World Heritage Site status.
And what's it like to do field work there?
It's fun. It's a difficult place to get to if you're a tourist, but when you're used to it, day in, day out, it's okay. So you have to drive 40 minutes from the nearest community down a gravel track and then park the car on the outside of the reserve and hike in anywhere between 15 minutes to an hour and a half to get to some of the fossil sites. And so you have to do that every day. You're not allowed to camp within the reserve. So it's quite physically demanding, but it's a beautiful place to work when the sun finally does come out. The coastline is spectacular. The problem is that about half the time you're there, probably in the summer months, it's completely foggy, so you can't really see very much at all.
Had the Precambrian rocks always been known to contain fossils, or was this somewhere where people have since visited to try and find them?
They were discovered at first in the 1960s. I think 1967 or 68, by a master's student at the local university, Morley University. And he was doing a mapping project. So he and his field assistant were surveying these sites. And I think the story goes that his field assistant actually stumbled across this bedding plane first. And they alerted their professor at Memorial and wrote that up as a science or nature paper, one of the two, in the 1960s. And that group worked on them for a little while, and then it wasn't really until the late 1990s that Guy Narbonne of Queen's University became involved in the area, and he has really been the driving force in developing Staken Point as a fossil site, describing all the taxa. And we started working there in about mid-2000s, I guess, and I've been there for about 6 years now.
Just a quick point. Did you just say a master's student got published in Nature?
Yeah, I think he was a master's student still when he...
I found it more impressive that the master's student had a field assistant. Where was my field assistant when I was working in there?
There's hope for us all yet.
Yeah, unfortunately, the assistant, I don't think, got very much credit for it. He definitely wasn't on the paper. And it wasn't until 2 years ago that the reserve manager at Staken Point actually found out his name. He was overlooked a bit. If it's true that he found it, then it's a bit disappointing that no one's really credited him with it. I could remember his name, I'd credit him now, but I can't.
What kind of environment do the rocks suggest Staken Point was in the Ediacaran period?
Staken Point, the successions are around 4 kilometres thick, and most of them are turbidite sequences, which are considered to have been deposited due to the huge thickness of the succession, with no evidence of shallow marine sedimentology in a deep marine backarc basin. And I say backarc because there's a lot of evidence for volcanic activity, and I'll talk more about that in a second when I talk about how the fossils are preserved, but there's a lot of volcanic tuffs and ashes which have been brought into the system and deposited on top of these turbidites intermittently. And so we're very close to these volcanic sources. And the deep water environments gradually, as you go up section, begin to shallow. And outside of the reserve, you go into much more fluvial, alluvial deposits. But those don't contain the fossils. And so there's an interesting question as to whether the organisms were constrained by the deep water marine environments, or whether they died out in that area. And a microcontinent of Avalonia is what Newfoundland and the UK at that time were part of, and the whole succession is thought to have become a lot shallower at that time period. So we then have to move to other continents such as Australia or Namibia to see the end of the story, what happened to the Ijikawa biota just before the Cambrian boundary.
So a turbidite is basically an underwater avalanche,
so
isn't
yes,
it?
That's right. So all of these are thought to have been deposited on a continental slope or at the base of that slope. So turbidites are just currents of water flowing down these slopes, entraining sediment, and the density of that sediment makes the turbidite a lot more powerful than just a water flow. And then all of that sediment is laid down in a very consistent sequence, and so you can recognize these things in the geological record. But at Mistaken Point, there's hundreds of these little turbidite packages ranging between 5 and up to about 40 or 50 centimeters in thickness throughout this whole succession. And pretty much the only thing that breaks that up are the volcanic ashes and tuffs that are found in between.
Let's get stuck into the fossils now. What kind of flora and fauna do we find in rocks at Mistaken Point? I mean, there must be many species. And do they have any living relatives or analogues which we can compare them to?
There are around 30 different species of fossils that have been found and described so far from Mistaken Point. But calling them flora or fauna is actually something that's quite contentious at the moment, because that would imply that we know what they are. And unfortunately, we don't. They're such strange organisms that we can't say definitively, yes, they were animals, or yes, they were plants. So we generally use the term biota to describe all of them. It's a very nitpicky point, but it's something that is quite important to getting a good understanding of where the status of this research is at the moment. Most of the species that have been described belong to an extinct group called the Rangiomorphs, and they're named after a fossil from Namibia called Rangia. They're all sort of frond-shaped, so almost like a fern, if you imagine a garden fern in the UK.
But not a plant, or not strictly
no,
a plant.
No, they're not thought to be plants because of the deep marine, greater than 1 kilometre water depth that they're considered to have been deposited beneath. Now, that is another contentious area of research at the moment, determining exactly what the water depth was that these organisms were living at. But if it's correct, and that's a long-held traditional view, then if you're more than 1 kilometre down in the ocean, you won't be able to get any light, and therefore you wouldn't be able to photosynthesize. And that's the main reasoning given for why they're not plants, even though there's a lot of morphological similarities between the Rangiomorphs and modern plant forms. Mm-hmm. So you can get these Rangiomorphs as single fronds, like a fern, or as clumped bushes of them. So there's forms such as Bradgatia, which look like cabbages or lettuces. We have lots of these fronds all arranged around each other. And they're all quite unusual. They don't seem to have any living relatives, and most of the possible biological groups that could be suggested to explain what they might be have been suggested, such as algae, cnidarians, so some modern sea pens, which are very, very similar in form to these, have all been suggested as being related, but most of them have largely been disproven. So we still don't really know what they were.
Have there been any kind of crazy concepts of what they could be?
There's been a few. So the suggestions that the Ijikawa biota as a whole may be related to fungi, may be related to lichens, all of these based on morphological similarities and sometimes mode of growth similarities to modern groups, to algae, to most groups of animals, so cnidarians, sponges, gastropods in some cases. Even microbial colonies have been suggested to explain some of the different forms. And although sometimes they do seem wacky interpretations for some of the fossils, there's usually some good reasoning or logic behind trying out those ideas in the first place relating to a few distinct forms. And what I think is that most of these groups were probably present in the Ediacaran period, and most of them are likely to be represented somewhere within the Ediacara biota, as well as maybe completely extinct forms that we'll never find living ancestors of. So it's trying to decode and get to the bottom of all of these competing hypotheses and take each organism on a case-by-case basis. And I think that's how we're going to actually manage to sort all of this out in the end and make the Ediacaran organisms appear not quite as enigmatic as they seem to an outsider.
So does the lack of modern analogues for these organisms make it a lot harder to infer their ecology and what they used to look like?
It does, because we're not entirely sure how they interacted with their environment, and you also don't have any original organic material with which to work to get to the bottom of what they might be. It is possible to get ecological data out of the assemblages, but you have to be very careful with it. There's previous studies that have looked into tiering and community structure of the different bedding planes, and also at ecological succession, so moving from less mature to more mature communities through the assemblages. But they've only really considered animals as a modern biological group to compare the Ediacaran fossils with. And until we, because of all the uncertainty surrounding what they might be, until we've looked at other modern biological groups such as algae or fungi or even plants to work out what their ecological parameters are and how they interact with each other, then it's a bit early, I think, to say that they are animals because they share a similar ecology to modern animals, for example. We can also look for evidence of their behavior. There's not very much of this, but there are now and again evidences of trace fossils, and also it's evidence for their spatial distribution, so the way in which they're arranged and assembled on the bedding plane relative to one another and how they might interact with each other. And there's people working here in Cambridge. Emily Mitchell is working on that sort of thing to get an idea of what they might be doing.
How is Emily doing this? I mean, what kind of techniques is she looking at to assess the spatial distribution?
She's doing a lot of computer modelling. So she's been to get the raw data on the site, and she used very high resolution, high precision GPS to measure exactly the distances between the centres of each of these organisms relative to one another on the bedding plane, and identified all the different species. And putting that into her modelling, she's been able to try and pick out the patterns that are present on two of the main surfaces in Mistaken Point, and also compare that to modern assemblages. And it's all very preliminary data at the moment. She hasn't published anything yet, but she's just writing her thesis up at the moment. So hopefully in the next couple of years, we'll get a lot more information on exactly where that's going and what it's found. But there's hints that there are relationships between some of these different organisms and how they might be behaving.
That has answered one of my questions, though, because in the back of my mind, with all of these turbidites, the underwater avalanches, I was wondering if these fossils, the biota, was allochthonous or autochthonous, and that is whether they are actually found preserved in their life position, or they've actually been moved from where they were living in one of these underwater avalanches. So if there's actually a way of seeing how they are spaced around each other, and if that's a consistent spacing, would that suggest that they are autochthonous and actually preserved in their life position?
Yes, we're assuming that they are, on the basis not necessarily of the patterns between them, but more on the fact that a lot of these Rangimor frondos organisms are tethered or anchored to the seafloor by a stem and this basal circular disc, which on a bedding plane, it's like a simple circle attaching the thing to the surface. But there's some very remarkable specimens recently been found in three dimensions where you can see that this disc is actually a bulb-shaped structure that seemed to be stuck within the sediment. And we're assuming that they're all, or inferring that they're all tethered to the seafloor, because on a lot of the surfaces, as you've had the turbidite current sweeping in, it's aligned all of the fronds on that surface. So all the points of the fronds are facing in the same direction. And we're assuming that that is because it's a unidirectional current has swept over them, swept more flat onto the surface, but not ripped them up and jumbled them up. Because on almost every single bedding plane, you get this alignment of fronds. We assume that that is exactly how they were positioned on the surface prior to the turbidite events or the ashfall that smothered them.
If the biota is shown to be attached to the surface, then how is it that you can get these trace fossils?
That's a very good question. And the trace fossils are something we found only in 2000 and, or described only in 2010. We found them in 2008, so very recently again. But they're a very rare component of the ecosystems. They're very small in terms of, in relation to the size of the general macrobiota, the main body fossils, such as the rhangimorphs that you find in the assemblages. And they're not found on a bedding plane with or alongside any of the macrofossils, the true Edeka biota. And so we're at a loss really to link known members of Edeka biota to these traces. But the traces do look very convincing. There's around 70 of them on the bedding plane, and they're consisting of two marginal ridges of sediments, raised sediments, which is thought to be sediment moved to the sides of the trace as the organism moved along an up to 17 centimeter long trackway, which has these hemispherical concavo-convex ridges of sediment stacked up within it, and they all concave faces all point towards this disc of the same size at the end of the trace, which is interpreted to be the body trace, the bottom of the trace maker. Now, that trace maker doesn't seem to have had a bottom surface that looked like any of the known rhangimorph specimens or similar specimens. So at present, we don't know what the organism was creating the traces. And we also don't see those traces on any of the other main fossil surfaces. And there's a variety of reasons that might be, or there's a variety of things that might be causing that. One is that you're looking at differential preservation either on top of or beneath microbial mat. Now, microbial mat isn't something I've mentioned yet, but it's thought that a lot of Ediacaran surfaces, because you have no bioturbation, you have no predation, have no scavenging, microbes will have grown on most of the surfaces on the organic matter within those environments and will have been able to get quite thick in terms of their surface covering and form this mat covering most of the sediments. This would have been quite sticky and almost leathery if it's very any similar to modern microbial mats. And it's thought that a lot of the high fidelity preservation of Ediacaran body fossils is because they are falling onto these microbial mats, and the mats mineralize rapidly around the outside surfaces of the organisms and cast them very quickly. Now, for the trace fossils, it may be that what we're seeing is preservation beneath where a microbial mat was, or at a layer within it, not on top of the mat. I'm just putting that out as a suggestion, but it's on the basis of there not being any body fossils on the surface and not being any traces on any of the hundreds of body fossil surfaces in the area. An alternative might be that they're shallow water forms that have been washed in one of the turbidity currents and just crawled around for a bit until they couldn't survive any longer at that depth. Or they may just be rare components of the assemblage. I mean, in modern marine settings and ecosystems, you can have quite a lot of variation in your communities over very short distances. And it may be that generally where we find body fossils preserved is not where the trace-making organisms like to live.
The base of the Cambrian is taken from the first occurrence of a complex trace fossil, isn't it? If I
Yes,
remember
that's
rightly.
correct.
And so, is there a behavioural difference between these two trace fossils? Is the one at the base of the Cambrian significantly more complex than the one in the Ediacaran at Mistaken Point?
Yes, there is a difference. So the basal Cambrian form is something called Treptychnus pedum, and that is a burrow where you get vertical expression of the burrow. So the organism was burrowing down into sediment. So the Mistaken Point forms and all Ediacaran trace fossils that are known of younger age as well are all horizontal forms. So either on the surface of the sediment or just beneath the surface of the microbial mats that were on the seafloor at that time, but not extending down into the sediment itself. So they're all surface locomotion traces rather than vertical. And that does seem to be a big shift in behaviour that still remains at the Cambrian boundary. So you get suddenly organisms capable of burrowing down into sediment. And that changes everything in terms of ecological structure of the environment. It changes the chemical conditions, so the redox zone, redox boundary, and exactly how much of the sediment is oxygenated. And therefore, that in turn affects the way you preserve soft-bodied organisms. And so that may be one reason why we're not seeing soft-bodied organisms preserved anywhere near as frequently in Phanerozoic rocks.
So the Cambrian explosion is one of the most famous points in the history of life on Earth, and it's where we first begin to see animals with hard parts preserved. So if all of these organisms we see in the Ediacaran are soft-bodied, how is it that they actually came to be preserved?
It's probably got something to do with the presence of microbial organisms and mats on the surfaces. And those mats would have smothered the bedding planes. A lot of the organisms are found to live either on top of them or anchored within them, with their discs beneath them and their fronds flapping in the water column above. But what's thought to have happened is that when the organisms died, and that's usually because of an event bed coming in, so be that a volcanic ash or tuff in Newfoundland or the UK, or in some of the younger Australian shallower water successions, they're storm deposits, so just another sandstone being deposited on top. The organisms would have been pushed down onto these mats, and the mats are thought to have rapidly lithified, mineralized the exteriors of the organisms, forming this death mask, it's been called, around their exterior, and casting in very high fidelity the impression of the organism before it decayed away. So when it would have decayed, you'd have had sediment from above or beneath filling the void that was in there. But this pyritic death mask formed by the microbes or the presence of microbes is what preserved the actual expression of the organism.
So does this have to do a lot with the geochemistry of these so-called like event rocks then? So if it's a kind of volcanic ash or a sandstone, does that make a difference how things are preserved?
No one has actually studied that yet. That's somewhere I'm about to go because we've just collected quite a few specimens of sedimentary specimens looking at the interface between ashes and the turbidite layers that these organisms were living on. And then also specimens where we've got no ash on top of a turbidite layer to see if there's any difference in the geochemistry there. So I'll be able to answer that in a few years' time, I
And we'll be happy to have you back. Do we have any evidence of like the intrinsic biology of these organisms?
think. Okay, in terms of what we know about what they were doing, there's a little bit of information we've managed to get. So, in terms of their metabolism, what they were eating and feeding on, it was initially thought that they might be filter feeders using pores within their exteriors or polyps attached to their exteriors, which may have drawn in organic material from the water column into the organism itself. But really remarkably preserved specimens from Newfoundland and also from the White Sea in Russia and Australia are starting to suggest that even at very fine scale, there's no evidence of these pores or polyps. And therefore, that method of feeding isn't viable. And so the most commonly held, widely held view at the moment is one from 2009, I think, from Mark Laflamme in Canada, suggesting that they might be osmotrophic, which is where organisms absorb dissolved carbon, organic carbon from the water column through their external membrane and into the organism itself. And no one's really come up with a better suggestion for what they might be doing since then. In terms of the way they reproduce, there's evidence for juvenile communities in Newfoundland, which would suggest from their distributions of all of these baby forms that they were possibly involved in a spawning mechanism of reproduction, whereby spores or juvenile fronds were thrown out into the water column as a spatful and landed on the surface randomly and then grew up into the adult forms. There doesn't seem to be any evidence for sort of fungal or plant feeder strings coming off mature specimens or for budding asexually off the organisms themselves. And also, in terms of the way they grow, that's one way we're trying to get to the actual biological affinities of these organisms by analyzing how they grow and how that differs or is similar to the way modern organisms grow in various different groups. And so, a lot of the rhangiomorphs belong in that clade together because they are made up of small branching fern-like elements called rhangiomorph units. And those are arranged in a variety of different ways and are added sequentially as the organism grows and also seem to inflate as it grows. And this way of studying things has already been able to disprove the hypothesis that these rhangiomorphs might be sea pens, for example, because it was shown in 2009 by Martin, my old supervisor, that the way a rhangiomorph adds its new growth elements is at the tip of the organism, whereas the way a sea pen adds its growth elements is at the very base of the frond. And the way in which an organism grows that very simple growth plan is not something that's likely to have changed throughout its evolution. And so, therefore, it's considered unlikely that rhangiomorphs are related to sea pens. So, these are the sorts of studies we're trying at the moment, and it's trying to get to the bottom eventually of what the things were, but in a very roundabout way, trying to work out what they were capable of, what they might have been doing, what sort of rigidity their tissues had, for example, and trying to piece all of that together to work out exactly what the things were in the end.
You've mentioned quite a few places where you can find these Ediacaran fossils. And you've also mentioned that Charnwood Forest and Mistaken Point were pretty close together in the old paleocontinent of Avalonia. Is it the case that all of these localities were pretty close together?
It's very difficult, I think, to work out paleogeographic reconstructions that far back. But what is agreed, I think, is that in the late Neoproterozoic, say from around 700 million to 542 million when the Cambrian started, you have at least two large supercontinents called Rodinia first and then Pannotia, a smaller one, which were rifting and breaking apart at this time. So you would have had a lot of major land masses all in very similar places, but they would all have then gone off to start their own evolutionary histories and on their own continental trajectories later. And they did span quite a range of paleo latitudes. There's sites in Siberia, in China, in northwest Canada, and Australia that would all have been in very different parts of the globe at the time they were deposited. So it's very difficult to say. And there's no way of constraining at all the longitudes of any of these sites. Thus, it does seem that there's quite a wide geographical range for the organisms and that they were truly a global biota.
And so, with the distance between the localities, do we also find the corresponding difference between the organisms and the preservations?
There's usually a slight difference in the fossil diversity, so the species present within the assemblages. And that might be due to a combination of the different ages of the different successions we have at these sites, the different sedimentary environments that we find them in. So some are deep water, like Newfoundland and the UK. Some are shallow marine intertidal. Some are slightly more distal. And also the latitudes. No one's ever looked at the paleolatitudes and how they may affect the assemblages. But the main control on what we see is actually the way they're preserved. So, as I mentioned before, the Newfoundland and UK deep water stuff is usually preserved beneath volcanic ashes, which can often be very coarse grained, but sometimes can be absolutely exquisite, very fine grained, and the resolution of your fossil preservation is dependent on how finely grained your sediment is, filling that fossil impression in. So in Newfoundland, you can get some very good preservation. You can also get some very terrible, bad preservation. Whereas in places like Australia and Namibia, you have shallow water storm deposits consistently being the facies in which the organisms are preserved. And so although you have quite coarse sand grains relative to some of the finer stuff you see in Newfoundland, you get the same consistency of preservation. And it's quite revealing in terms of the different types of organisms you get. There's even a suggestion that in Namibia, some of the organisms are preserved in the sediment and actually might have been living within the sediment when they died. And then there's very recently discovered successions in northern Siberia, which are carbonates. And at the moment, that's the only place in the world where we find carbonate preservation of the Ediacaran macrobiota. And so there's only been one paper so far on that biota, but hopefully there's a lot more to come out of it in the future. And again, there are some species that are shared from Siberia and that succession with Leicestershire, for example, Charnia is present, but there's also a lot of things that are very different. And it's using these different taphonomic preservational windows and looking through all of them at the Ediacaran that we'll be able to get a better handle on the global distribution and the global relationships between each of these assemblages.
On one hand, we have these Ediacaran biotas, and on the other, we have the Cambrian fauna. So what kind of events took place over this boundary between the two? Was it a biological or geological transition? And if so, did changes in the biota drive changes in Earth systems, or was it changes in Earth systems which drove the evolution of the biotas?
That's a very good question, and most of the Ediacaran research at present is looking at exactly that. So there are very big biological and geological changes across the Ediacaran's Cambrian transition. From a biological point of view, you have ecosystems which have been dominated by microbes for almost 3 billion years, suddenly having an influx of large complex organisms and then moving towards the metazoan-dominated ecosystems of the Phanerozoic. You have the development of ecological behaviors and things like bioturbation, locomotion in the first place, just surface locomotion before that, and then bioturbation, evolution of predation and scavenging, all of which would have changed the dynamic on the seafloor and meant that organisms would have to start biomineralizing. You have the first biomineralizers coming in. And all of this took place over a period of maybe 50 to 60 million years, probably, but in a geological instant, almost. And every single one of these would have both had an effect on the surrounding environment, but also have been affected by it. So the main geological events we have, I've mentioned the snowball Earth events. The final one might not have been quite as extensive, but there's some evidence to suggest that at its end, around 580 million years ago, there was a rise in global oxygen levels. So in the water column, and assumed to have been a rise in atmospheric oxygen levels. Mm-hmm. And a change in water chemistry from ocean chemistry, from quite iron-rich ferruginous oceans, and in this place is quite euxinic, so high levels of free sulfur sulfide, to this far more oxygenated environment. And it's thought that that may have driven the initial evolution of the Ediacara biota. So a rise in oxygen levels to something that can support large organisms being able to get all of their oxygen needs from the surrounding environment. But as we change the oxygen levels and oxygenate the water column, you also change the style of preservation and the style of the chemical gradients on the seafloor itself and the interface between the water column and the sediment. And this chemistry is something that if you were to study a microbial mat in an oxygenated environment, you'll see that there's a gradation in the organisms. There's a very clear and defined sequence in which different metabolisms of microbes are found within the surface and the substrate. And that usually occurs over a very small, a couple of millimeters in thickness of the sediment. So once you get in the Cambrian, the evolution of vertical burrowing, for example, that immediately means you start mixing the sediments. You break through these microbial mats. The mats find it harder to exist, and any organisms that would have been feeding off them would find it a lot harder to adapt to those environments. But also by mixing the sediments, you oxygenate it, and that allows more organisms to penetrate into it and burrow themselves. And it's a positive feedback loop. There's this constant cycle of the further down in the sediment you start to oxygenate, the more habitable it becomes for other organisms. And so it's likely that with all of these different biological innovations, they're all linked in some way to ocean chemistry and conditions at that time, but that each of them would have had a feedback which would have further affected the ocean. For example, if you biomineralize, you're starting to take calcium, for example, or phosphorus out of the water column, and therefore you're completely changing the chemistry for planktonic organisms, let's say, who are utilizing those nutrients. And so all of this happened very abruptly over the transition, and it's probably, in my mind, the biggest change in the biosphere that has ever occurred on the planet. So moving from this microbial to macroscopic realm and all of the changes that took place alongside it, it really is one of the most interesting points in the history of life on Earth.
Sounds incredibly complicated too.
It's a
I take
pain
it.
because you have to know all sorts of things about all sorts of bits and pieces, including chemistry, unfortunately, which isn't very nice.
So what happened to this Ediacaran biota? Did it die out at this stage?
It seems that you get changes in the biota as you move through the end of the Ediacaran period. So you start to get forms which start to biomineralize, and you lose some of the rangiomorphs, for example. But that may be because we're looking at different environments to when we were looking at the rangiomorph-dominated ones earlier in the period. But what is quite clear is that when you get to the Cambrian boundary, your Ediacaran biota suddenly disappears. And although there are one or two possible survivors that have been reported, such as a form called Thaumaptilon, which looks quite a lot like a rangiomorph frond from the Burgess Shale in Middle Cambrian, there are very few of these, and it doesn't appear that they survived in any great numbers. Although the big changes in preservation at the Cambrian boundary may be responsible for this, and your lack of, or apparent lack of, soft-bodied organisms.
We've heard a lot about rock record biases and fossil record biases. Do you think these might be playing a role in this transition? You know, for example, we simply aren't seeing any rock around the transition. So what looks like an abrupt transition could actually just be a product of the fact that we don't have any transitional fossils preserved.
Okay. There are quite a few sections around the world where you do see this transition, but a lot of them seem to be in very shallow water settings. At least the type section in Newfoundland, which records the official boundary, is a marine section with a lot of red beds, and there's not actually many fossils at all in that. but it is a continuous sequence through. But you're also missing two key components there. You're missing the ashes, which preserve most Newfoundland fossils because the volcanism seems to have died out at that point. And you're also missing evidence for the abundant microbial mats. So although we do have the rock sequences of that age, we don't have the preservation, but it may be taphonomic reasons that are responsible for that rather than just an absence of the organisms. As for reasons for why they might have disappeared, they may have been outcompeted by metazoans that we know were starting to evolve at this time. They might have lost their food source if they were feeding off mats or off mat-related detritus. Then, as organisms started to feed off the mats or burrow through them, then that could have wiped them out. Or they may just have been a very easy target for predators, as most of these Ziegakaran organisms were sessile, living in one place attached to the seafloor. They wouldn't have been able to move to escape. But there's a lot to be learnt still, and that's something that a lot of groups are currently investigating further.
So in our very first episode, we heard of the existence of older single-celled fossils, but do you think it's possible that we'll be able to find sites with older macro fossils?
I wouldn't be surprised if we do. There's a lot of parts of the world with Ediacaran successions that haven't been properly studied yet, or only just being opened up either for political reasons or because they're so remote. In Russia, for example, has vast areas that still need investigation and study. And as I said before, there's a new discovery in Ediacaran or Cryogenian paleontology almost every month, which completely changes the way we view a certain animal or organic group, biological group. So yes, there's a lot of potential for new finds. One problem we do have with Ediacaran paleontology, it's not really a problem, but it's something you definitely have to think about more than during the rest of the Phanerozoic, is that the systems, because they were so different chemically and taphonomically and biologically, you can't just assume that they behaved in the same way as ecosystems do today, or that they're uniformitarian. That is that you can apply modern principles to the Ediacaran. You often have to think outside the box in order to understand what's going on, which makes it far more interesting for me because it means I can use my imagination a bit. But it also makes it a lot more difficult to really get to the bottom of some of these points because there's so many competing hypotheses and so many variables at the time. This large number of potential avenues to research in so many different locations is part of what makes the Ediacaran period so interesting. There's so much still to do. And as we've discussed, almost all the questions you've asked, big fundamental questions about how they evolved, what they were, how they fed, how they reproduced, we don't know for certain any of that. And those are all things that researchers will have to get to the bottom of in the near future. So it's definitely one of the main frontier areas in paleontology.
Right, so you've been listening to Alex Liu talking about the Ediacaran fauna or biota of Mistaken Point. What do you think, John?
I think it really well. I learned quite a bit. How about you?
Yeah, I didn't really know that we couldn't assign any of this biota to either animals, plants, or other. It's surprising that we know so much about the morphology, yet we don't know what these organisms are related to.
Well, it's a direction for research in the future.
Oh, definitely. There's so much more potential.
Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at PaleoCast. That's with an A for you Americans. And we also have a Facebook page at www.com/PaleoCast. See you there.
Ah, I should also mention that in the last episode, if anyone noticed, I said Northwest America and not Northeast America. So big apologies to everyone in Northwest America. Big apologies to them in Northeast America, Central America, Canada. Hey, it's all still Northwest to me.
Dave, you're a shambles.
Yeah, that's the quality you get in here in PaleoCast.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at Paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.